I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third generation family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about 10 bucks a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn Best Buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something. The folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine. And yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly. Just to be here and talk a little bit just so I can check the level in your voice.
Yes, hello. My name is Lindy, and I had a croissant this morning for breakfast that was supposed to be a muffin. I ordered a muffin, and they brought me a croissant, and I was too shy to say anything because it seemed embarrassing to storm back and demand a muffin.
Why is that? Would that be embarrassing?
I don't know. I just got self-conscious. As a fat person, you're always under surveillance when you're eating or when you're in proximity to food. So demanding my muffin, my rightful muffin, just seemed like making too much of a scene. So I just didn't. And the croissant was fine.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. Lindy West is a leading voice of the fat acceptance movement, which is a position that's earned her a lot of devoted fans, but also a lot of enemies. In fact, she's been the target of so many online attacks and threats that a few years ago, she had to shut down her Twitter account. She's the author of the best-selling book, Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman, which has been adapted into a TV series on Hulu. Now, in one of my favorite passages of her book, Lindy writes, "When you're a fat person, you can't hide your vulnerability because you are it and it is you. Being fat is like walking around with a sandwich board that says, here's where to hurt me. That's why reclaiming fatness, living visibly, declaring I'm fat and I'm not ashamed, is a social tool so revolutionary, so liberating. It saves lives." Now, that part's pretty serious. But I should also say that a lot of the book is hilarious. I spoke to Lindy back in 2017, and I've been thinking a lot about that conversation lately as articles about pandemic weight gain are making the rounds, and ads for new COVID diets are popping up all over social media. Lindy and I met up at the Square Diner. It's an old school spot in Lower Manhattan. She had been doing a ton of traveling for her book talks, and she had gotten herself into one of those VIP lounges at the airport where they have free food. She posted a photo on Instagram of a ham and cheese panini she made herself in the lounge. So, of course, I had to get details.
I can't believe you're asking me about this. Okay, so they have
spread
of cold cuts and breads and cheeses. And mustard is the key. And then they have a DIY panini press. So you can take this bread and put mustard on it and put a piece of cheese and some ham and a tomato slice if you like, and then throw it in the panini press. And then you have a DIY ham and cheese and mustard sandwich hot at the airport, toasted. And it is bomb. And it's not like you can just recreate it at home because you don't have a panini press at home. At least I don't. I think they're expensive.
And it feels more special, just like when you're living this first-class existence.
Absolutely.
All these high rollers around. I'm going to teach you a thing or two.
Yeah, it makes you look like you know what you're doing in the Qantas Lounge.
Right. You're like, this is not my first rodeo. Right,
exactly. And then you impress all the businessmen.
Right.
Not really. They don't care about you. Actually, they can tell that you don't belong, but that's fine.
And what was your technique? Tell me about how did you layer the ham and the cheese?
Okay. Well, okay. Yeah, I can.
Please.
We can get into this.
Yeah, that's...
First, a lot of mustard.
Okay.
I feel like when I was a child, I was like, get that away from me. And now I just cannot get enough of it on my food.
Yes, me too.
I'm obsessed with it.
Doesn't it make you feel like you're a real adult?
Yes.
Once you start switching to mustard?
Absolutely. So big smear that. I mean, the smart thing to do is like rip the cheese in half and do half of the cheese, then the ham, then the other half of the cheese.
So you get cheese on top and bottom.
So that the sandwich holds together.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a mortar.
Exactly.
It fuses.
I tried it once with two pieces of cheese. It was too much cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And these are those like sort of pre-cut slices, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I would do, I think, mustard, ham, cheese bread.
Were you at all self-conscious there?
No, weirdly, no. Because of the aforementioned cred I felt like it gave me in the lounge community. And also, you know, there's nothing wrong with a nice, wholesome sandwich. It's more like foods that we code as bad that are sort of nerve-wracking to eat in public. Like, they would have sometimes a small, mediocre cake in the business lounge. I avoided that. And it also didn't look good. Should we look at these menus?
Let's do it.
All right. Do you have recommendations?
I kind of came here with omelet on the mind. Like, ooh, if I'm coming to a diner, I'm usually going to get an omelet.
You're doing breakfast. God, that's really opening my mind up to the fact that I could get pancakes right now.
You could.
And eat them.
You could.
God, I hadn't even considered.
But then you could, you know, the problem with the diner is you get flummoxed by the paradox of choice.
I know.
That's why I think the first thing you got to do before you even look at the menu is decide breakfast or lunch, because that will eliminate some choices.
I think I'm going to go with my original instinct, which was lunch.
Okay.
Hmm. All right.
I think I'm going to go mushroom omelet, American cheese.
Ugh. I love that idea.
All right. After you, Lindy.
Hello. Can I get the sweet and spicy chicken sandwich?
Right.
Yes, please. And a chocolate malt.
Could I please have a mushroom omelet with American cheese?
Anything to drink?
I'll take a coffee along with a milkshake.
Did you order your milkshake?
Oh, I didn't say. She did. Vanilla, please.
Okay, fantastic.
Thank you.
Got it.
All right, what else should we talk about?
Well, I saw that you are a big fan of the Lean Cuisine French bread pizza. Is
yes.
that right? Pepperoni? Yeah.
French bread, pepperoni pizza, Lean Cuisine. Specifically, not the other, not your standard Lean Cuisine round pizza. Those are a disaster.
Right.
But they're the French bread pizza, Lean Cuisine pizzas are like legitimately good.
I grew
eat.
Up on those.
Yeah.
Saturday
yeah,
nights.
Yeah, because my mom would eat them. I have a theory because I recently had a Red Baron French bread pepperoni pizza.
Okay.
And I think that the Lean Cuisine might just be the Red Baron with some of the pepperonis picked off to make it lean.
Right, look how lean it is.
Because the pepperoni is the same weird triangle shape. This is just a hypothesis. I have not tested it. I haven't done a side-by-side analysis.
Right.
But it's my hunch. I feel like it's a good one.
Yeah, I like it.
So exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Man, I should have gotten vanilla.
Mmm.
Is it good? Can I try it?
Yeah, please do.
Oh, man. If my internet trolls get a hold of this, just an hour of me drinking a milkshake and talking about pepperoni.
But, well, that's, you know, it occurs to me that for you, in some way, like for you to just hang out and nerd out on frozen pizzas and milkshakes is like a political act.
I pay a great price.
How
I mean, really,
so?
It's true. It's different for me to do this than for you to do this. Because people, like I said, people watch what I eat and what food I talk about. And, you know, if you're going to be a fat person who achieves any level of respect, you have to be the kind of apologetic, always on a diet fat person.
So you prefer fat as opposed to any other word?
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's more honest. I don't tell other people how they have to refer to themselves, but I personally don't like being referred to with euphemisms. They're still calling me fat, but they're also drawing attention to the fact that they're uncomfortable with my body. You know what I mean? And so my end goal would be to make it okay to be fat and to let people live their lives, their complicated, long, busy lives without having to carry around this stigma. And so I think the more you can use the word in a neutral way and model that neutrality and say, yeah, I'm fat and there's nothing wrong with being fat, that has a political impact and it ripples outward and it changes the way that other people think about themselves and the way that people treat each other.
One of the things that really struck me that you talked about in interviews and in your book is this idea of sort of the good or acceptable fat person versus the bad fat person.
Yeah.
Can you kind of explain that difference a little more?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm drinking milkshake.
Finish your chocolate milkshake before you go on.
Okay, so when I started writing about being fat, it was still totally open season, like just be horrible and cruel to fat people for their own good. And then I feel like there people got it into their heads that maybe that was not a good look to just be gratuitously mean. And, you know, more and more fat people started to be like, hello, I am a person and I am a human being and deserve basic dignity and respect. And so then people put these qualifiers on it, like, okay, well, it's still okay to berate and abuse fat people if they aren't doing everything that they can to become thin people. Because we have this idea that being fat is never a permanent state, that you're just a thin person who is a failure. And so it's totally acceptable to nag and insult and harass fat people if they aren't fulfilling their duty to, you know,
like if they aren't feeling the shame that other people think they're supposed to feel.
Well, not just feeling the shame, but well, definitely. Yeah. I mean, people don't like it if you don't feel the shame. They get very mad, but it's not just feeling the shame. Like you have to be sort of demonstrating and performing your penance. Like you have to be ostentatiously eating salad in public at all times and going to the gym and posting on Instagram about going to the gym, except also when you go to the gym, people are mean to you because it's not real. Like you can try as hard as you can to be the good kind of fat person and they still hate you. They just might not insult you to your face quite so often. So I would rather not have to choose between good fatty and bad fatty and just be a person. I mean, I guess I choose bad because the game is rigged. It's not real. You know, you can't actually, you should not have to try to win your humanity, but also you can't because people don't actually care about your health and they don't actually care about their insurance premiums. They care about having someone to take a dump on.
That's the short version of the answer to a question Lindy says she gets a lot. In fact, she gets it so much that a few weeks before our interview, she wrote a piece in The Guardian saying she won't answer it anymore. And the question goes like this. By promoting fat acceptance, aren't you encouraging people to be unhealthy? Her response is basically that, first, there are a lot of reasons why someone may be fat. And many of those reasons are beyond a person's control. But no matter the reason, treating fat people like garbage sure doesn't help. In her Guardian piece, she writes, if you claim to care about fat people's health but do nothing to fight fat stigma, you are a liar. And as Lindy told me, that stigma is especially bad when food's around, like at the grocery store. She says she's gotten past a lot of those issues, but she hasn't forgotten them.
It's definitely performative at the grocery store. It's like, even if I'm going to the grocery store, and I still do this to sometimes if I'm feeling, you know, insecure that day. It's like, if I have to go to the grocery store to buy a birthday cake for my child, I will be self-conscious and also get like a big bunch of carrots that I don't need so right. That people don't think that I'm just fat lady buying a whole cake on a Saturday night to go eat it while crying, you know, which is not even, you know, not the case. And also it's fine if that's what you want to do. It's not my business. You eat whatever you want. If you want to eat a whole cake while crying, I mean, I'm sorry that you're crying. Now I'm concerned about this fictional person that I invented in my head, but but you know, there's always this, like, how can I temper this bad food with a good food so that people don't think that, like, God forbid I was actually going to eat this.
Or at least it comes across like a quote unquote normal person buying
right, exactly.
a full slate of groceries that might include some sweets and some vegetables. Right.
Or, you know, sometimes I would do like a big theatrical, like, just got to pick up this candy right. for my mom.
Right.
Even if I was buying candy for myself, you know, like, oh, no, it's not for me. I prefer jicama. I don't know. It's just like, there's no way you can slice it that having that kind of a relationship with food is healthy or makes you healthier. It just makes you miserable and fixated on food all the time, you know, because you have to constantly be thinking about it. And I don't know. I think that...
And I would suspect that even at home, when you're alone, away from prying eyes, it's still really hard to enjoy a meal.
Yeah, I mean, because you still have those thoughts. I mean, it's better to eat in private alone. You're less self-conscious. But yeah, I mean, it's not like you can just turn that off.
Coming up, my conversation with Lindy West continues. Her husband's body type is really different from hers. She'll talk about the way people react to them when they're together. Plus, when your goal in life is to instill confidence in others, what do you do on the days when you don't feel so confident yourself? I'll ask Lindy. Stick around.
Ooh, advertisements. Yummy.
Norwegian Cruise Line breaks the boundaries of global cruise travel. When you cruise with NCL, you're going to get award-winning specialty restaurants, a variety of food and beverage offerings, immersive entertainment, and the most thrilling experiences at sea. It is first class. These ships have all kinds of specialty restaurants, Brazilian steakhouse, French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Mexican. Select ships also feature alfresco dining on the waterfront and Ocean Boulevard, an oceanside promenade lined with bars and restaurants. Norwegian provides guests with truly authentic and fresh dining and bar experiences complemented by exceptional service. Almost everything you'll eat is prepared from scratch by highly experienced chefs. And they got whatever you're going to be in the mood for. You want a quick casual family meal? They've got that. You want a beautiful four-course feast? They've got that too. And you can sip something delicious at one of up to 23 unique bar and lounge options per ship. Visit and explore exciting destinations around the world and enjoy unique experiences on board. With no set dining and entertainment times and no formal dress codes, you have the flexibility to design your ideal vacation. Book your next adventure at ncl.com. Recently, I went into my closet to try to get a collared shirt out, and it occurred to me that I don't think I have bought a new collared shirt in 5 years. I mean, every shirt in there was either really old, or it had some kind of perma-stain situation, or it probably never fit right in the first place. I gotta freshen up a little bit here. It's time for something new, right? And spring is coming. Now is the time if you've been looking to refresh your wardrobe, home, or skincare and beauty routines this season. Because, you know, Walmart has genuinely surprising style finds that don't break the bank. This spring, there's only one destination for the latest fashion, home, and beauty inspired by real life. Walmart. I freshened up my wardrobe. I got some nice dress shirts, a couple light hoodies. You know, you need light hoodies for the springtime. Very useful, very comfortable. Discover surprisingly stylish new season favorites at Walmart now, or shop it all on the Walmart app. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending. Now trending, your style at Walmart. This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. We have a dog. Her name is Sasha. She's almost four. She's a standard poodle. She's black and fluffy and soft and very adorable. And when we first got her, we took her to like this puppy kindergarten training class. The whole family went. And, you know, they're teaching you how to use the treats and all this. The trainer watched Sasha for a bit and said, she's very food motivated. And my daughter Emily turned to me and said, she's a Pashman. And so she is food motivated. And that's why we make a point of feeding Sasha high quality pet food. Founded in Hereford, Texas, Merrick has been crafting high-quality dog food for over 30 years. Real is Merrick's recipe, so they always use deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. And let me tell you something. When it's dinner time, Sasha is motivated, okay? She is highly motivated to come in from patrolling the backyard at dinner, to get up off the couch, whatever she's doing, she will drop it and come running. Check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. I just got a very wonderful shipment of goodies from the folks at Reese's. And let me tell you something. These people remain the absolute worldwide leaders in bringing together chocolate and peanut butter. Of course, we know the peanut butter cups remain transcendent. But have you tried the Reese's Sticks? They're wafers with peanut butter in between each wafer, all coated in chocolate. I mean, the combination of sweet chocolate and salty peanut butter just brings people joy, and the folks at Reese's do it better than anyone. So shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you, found wherever candy is sold.
Well,
Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. Hey, on last week's show, I visit Jake Cohen. He's the author of Jew-ish, Reinvented Recipes from a Modern Mensch, and he's become a social media star. This book has really expanded how I think about what Jewish food in America is and what it can be.
Perfect example, kasha varnishkas. I think of that dish, which is this old school Ashkenazi dish of bow tie pasta with buckwheat groats. And I think of it as like this sad deli side in a cup. And I thought, like, why don't we turn it into like a weeknight pasta? That's like fun. And I add like lemon zest and tons of chopped dill and fancy mushrooms. That is celebrating and moving Jewish food forward through the lens of Jewish joy and not trauma.
When Jake was younger, Judaism wasn't a big part of his identity. Hear the story of how it came to be the focus of his whole career in our conversation. It's up now. All right, let's get back to Lindy West. Our food arrived. I sandwichized my omelet in a toasted English muffin, as I am wont to do. Lindy quite liked her sweet and spicy chicken sandwich, and we kept chatting. In her writings, Lindy talks about the fact that when a lot of people see a fat person, they feel a sort of visceral disgust. I asked her where she thinks that reaction comes from.
I mean, I used to feel that, so I understand that that feeling is real. But I think that, I mean, based on how easy it was for me to think myself out of that cycle, you know, I think it's something that we're sold really aggressively and conditioned into, because a lot of people make a lot of money off of our body insecurities and our body hierarchy, and telling people that there's something wrong with them is a great way to get their money. I mean, the thing that helped me come to terms with my body was looking at diverse bodies, just looking at them, you know, scrolling through endless fat fashion blogs and just looking at people's bodies until they didn't give me that jarring feeling anymore.
You just like reprogrammed yourself.
Yeah.
So I should say, So I grew up, I was a fat kid. My brother, too, both my parents were fat kids. This was like a gene in my family, fat kids, and we kind of all hit puberty and stretched out. And I was going to kind of bring that up and kind of compare notes with you, and then it occurred to me, like, well, being a fat kid certainly isn't the greatest in a lot of ways, but I wonder if it bothers you and people who've had that experience compare or act like they understand your experience.
It does irritate me. Actually, I hadn't really thought about it, but I mean, it's fine. Everyone's entitled to their experiences, but it is different. It's different to never grow out of that. You know what I mean? To never, to not have that just be a phase, and to try to make a life as an adult, as a fat adult, because it changes your employment opportunities and your romantic opportunities and the way that every single person treats you. And that's not to say that it's not incredibly painful for a lot of kids who are bullied and who are, you know, who face the same kind of stigma that fat adults do. But it's very, very frightening and painful to face the reality that you might and probably will statistically be fat forever. You know, as to have to come to terms with that as an adult when you're told your whole life that this is the worst possible thing you can be and there's no possible way to be fat and happy. It's really like deeply frightening and traumatic. You hear fat phobic adults say things like, well, I was a fat kid and, you know, I grew out of, or, you know, I'm not fat anymore, so therefore, why don't you just stop being fat? Or like, yeah, when I was in high school, I started jogging and now I'm not fat. So you should go back in time and learn to jog and then you will be me. Right. Which is like, I mean, I played three sports in high school. I mean, the idea that fat people aren't active is a lie. The idea that fat people don't know about exercise is a lie. I guess people love to assign a sort of moral value to things that aren't necessarily accomplishments. Like, oh, you grew 6 inches in high school and suddenly you weren't fat anymore. And you think that displays some sort of like
virtue.
Virtue.
Right.
I mean, we instill very fraught and toxic relationships with food in kids when they're very young. And I you know, for some reason, no one wants to address that because it's more fun to just abuse fat people.
And easier.
Yeah, and easier.
Right. You and your husband are not of a similar body type. Is that fair to say?
Oh, my God. And he's only getting worse and worse. We're making a film, and he has to play a 25-year-old. So he's like, obsessed with the gym now, and he's constantly working out. He used to just be, like, tall and skinny, and now he's, like, a weird, annoying, muscle-bound Adonis.
That sounds awful.
It is so annoying. And I'm just, like, fat, and, like, I also go to the gym. Every day that he goes to the gym, the same thing does not happen to me. So, I don't know. It's not fair. I mean, it's fine because I don't care. Obviously, my whole life's work is about being happy with the body that you have. It's just funny. But anyway, yeah. So I have a skinny, hot husband, and then I am a fat, hot lady, or whatever. I don't think of myself as hot, but I feel like I should say that for the gals out there, model that confidence, which is weird. People don't assume that we're a couple. Every restaurant, the server asks if we want separate checks or just bring separate checks. Women try to pick him up at all times when we're in public. But it's
when you're with him.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, I'll just be sitting there like, hello. It's weird. I mean, it's just weird, I think, the assumptions that we make about people needing to match their partner. And I think there's this pressure on men, especially, to constantly upgrade to, like, the most conventionally hot woman you can get. And because of that system, people assume that I guess that I'm a witch. I cast a spell on him or something. Or that he has some sort of fetish or something. And that it couldn't possibly just be two adults who love each other. I don't know. That's totally baffling to people.
I was reading up on this a little bit, and I saw a fascinating study where they showed the people in this taking the study pictures of different romantic couples with different body types, and the people were asked to rate how favorable or unfavorable their perception of each romantic couple was. The highest, most favorable rating went to a couple that were both people were skinny.
Yeah.
The next rating down was where both people are fat.
Yeah.
The lowest rating was a skinny person and a fat person together.
Yeah.
Which was lower than two fat people.
Yeah, because you're supposed to match your partner. I mean, we have a model for fat man, skinny woman, because men can do whatever they want. But fat woman, skinny man is so confusing for people and weirdly threatening. It's like, I mean, it's kind of the same as if just being a fat person who doesn't hate yourself. There's this idea that you somehow cheated or, you know, you took something that wasn't yours. When people spend their whole lives participating in diet culture and pouring money and time into it with the promise that at the end you win happiness and fulfillment. And then a person like me declares that I deserve happiness and fulfillment now and then just goes and lives that way. People are like, wait, I really invested a lot in this. What have I been doing with my life for the last 20 years? I could have just skipped to the finish line and been happy. I mean, and obviously there's nothing wrong with setting goals and doing whatever you want with your body. I'm just saying it's not a magic trick where you're magically happy. So anyway, I think people are threatened by fat people having things that we construe as prizes for obedience and physical beauty, you know?
Right. One of the phrases you've used a couple times we've been talking is model confidence, that you try to view it as sort of part of your work to model confidence. That's something I kind of wanted to ask you about, which is, like, we all have days when we're not feeling so confident and so great about ourselves. But it's like so much of the work you've taken on in your career is to project a certain way that you feel about yourself. How do you deal with that on the days that you don't feel that way inside?
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I'm not feeling it, I don't bother. You know, I mean, there are plenty of days where I just go out in a giant sweater and hide myself, you know what I mean? Like, swaddle myself in 40 yards of wool and, like, slink around, you know what I mean? Like, there's no mandate that you have to be perfect every day to live a good life and to be a happy, confident person. If I'm telling fat people, fat women especially, that they need to just fight back against this pressure to be perfect all the time and, you know, go be yourself and live with confidence and believe in yourself. And then also you have to do that perfectly. Right. And if you ever mess it up, then you're doing,
you suck.
Then you suck. And you're not even being fat. Right. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the real answer is like, you just get to live and you get to be flawed and you get to be unhappy. You know, you don't even have to be happy. I hope that people find, like, give themselves space and permission to achieve happiness, but this pressure to have a great day, a great Instagram worthy day every single day, is totally unrealistic. I don't think that pressure serves anyone, you know?
I know, in your book, you talk about other issues besides body image.
What?
I know, it's crazy. So before we say goodbye, I wanted to ask you, like, what's another part of your book that you feel like you never get asked about or hardly ever get asked about that you wish you got asked about more, that you would be eager to talk about?
No one ever asks me about periods.
Go on.
I don't know why. No, now that I don't want to talk about periods. Okay. I do think it's unreasonable that we have to have them and that men don't have to have them, that cisgender men don't have to have them, because they are really intrusive and expensive and they take up a lot of time and a lot of mental energy. And the least that men could do is read my very disgusting period chapter in my book. Right. You know what I mean? I mean, I know so much about adolescent boners. There's like plenty of media about like, oh, I got an awkward boner in math. I had to use my folder to, like, yeah. I mean, and I guess there are books about periods, but did you read them? I don't think boys read.
I do remember learning about it in, like, in health class, but it wasn't exactly,
but
like,
you weren't reading like Judy Blume books about.
No.
Yeah.
Right.
But I feel like girls read books about boys' lives because they're just presented as books. And
right.
Not. I don't know. I mean, I'm going off on a tangent and I haven't thought any of this through, but it feels true.
Well, that's good enough in today's day and age.
It's just a food podcast.
Yeah.
Not a facts podcast. Yeah.
That's Lindy West. Her New York Times bestselling book is Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. And you can see the TV version of Shrill on Hulu. Lindy's also written two other books, The Witches Are Coming and Shit, Actually, the definitive 100% objective guide to modern cinema. On next week's show, I talk with Queer Eye's Anthony Porofsky. When the show first came out, everyone had one question. Can this guy actually cook? I'll ask him how that felt for him then and how he feels about it now. That's next week. Meantime, if you're looking for more Sporkfuls, check out last week's show, where I talk with Jake Cohen, who translates old-school Jewish recipes into viral TikTok videos. That's in your feed right now. This show is originally produced by me and Anne Sani, with editing help from Dan Charles. Our senior producer is Emma Morgenstern. Our producer is Andres O'Hara. This episode was mixed by Casey Holford, music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Daisy Rosario and Peter Clowney. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Andrew from Downey, California, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.